Well, welcome back. We are in volume two of Jesus Christ, Supernut or Supernatural. This is a study done by Dr. Gene Scott over 40 years ago. We're in volume two now, the subtitle of which is Jesus Christ Was Different, you know? And we pick up reading. This mishmash of tolerant ecumenicity is enough to confuse any searching person, young or old, unless he takes the trouble to sort facts from tradition for himself. The facts show Jesus to be in unique contrast to other founders of world religions. From India to Japan, I have traced the path of Buddhism in previous years, both as a searching student in comparative religions at Stanford University, and in multiple world trips to these areas. The Gautama Buddha can be respected as a wise and good teacher, and the historic facts will support this position. The same can be said for Confucius, whose wise teachings, effect, and beautiful temples grace so much of the Oriental world. The vast religious streams flow from Muhammad's work is obvious to see in Istanbul. I've studied them elsewhere too, and talked to its believing adherents, from fanatical Moros of the Isle of Mindanao in the Philippines to here in Turkey. In every case, this founder of the Islamic faith never claimed to be anything but a man. To him, there was only one God, Allah, and Muhammad was his prophet. The confusion enters when Jesus Christ is loosely thrown into the same elevated class with these other religious founders. In the seed of tolerance comes the fruit of distortion. The founder fallacy in religious thought takes over, namely, that all founded religions having world influence had similar founders. That simply is not true. The Gautama Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad have similar qualities of self-recognized human limitations, human needs, and human position before their respective views of ultimate reality. And the historic records bear out this self-limitation by the founder. Jesus Christ was unique, and the records of his life clearly show this also. It is precisely that uniqueness of Christ from other historic founders of religion on which this volume focuses. Jesus Christ was different. To really look at him as history reveals him is to know this. So let's look. Jesus Christ considered himself to be morally perfect. Abundant evidence in the gospel suggests that Christ felt no sense of moral imperfection, no sense of moral shortcoming before God or his laws. Christ's attitude toward the law of the Israelites most significantly illustrates this. In the Sermon on the Mount, Christ himself condemned the superficial keeping of the law by the Israelites. No man with honest introspection can read this sermon, which condemns evil thoughts equally with evil deeds, without sensing his own moral shortcomings alongside such a standard. Yet Christ says, in the very midst of the Sermon on the Mount, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law. I'm not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." You find that in Matthew 5. Notice, Christ claims to fulfill that which must not pass away until all is fulfilled. And even all that, which by its very nature convicts a man of his inadequacies and moral shortcomings. The Apostle Paul took the respected position of a good and wise man when faced with the law. He says in Romans 7, "I had not known sin but by the law." In this passage, Paul teaches that the very function of the law is to convict man of his sins. Also notice Jesus' acceptance of the term lamb in chapter 1 of John's Gospel. The term in this context implied a perfection associated with the sacrificial lamb of Jewish ritual. Christ's attitude toward those seeking forgiveness for their sins further indicates a sense of moral perfection. Jesus never reflects the humility which ought to be present in a normal person to whom sins are confessed, a humility called forth by the recognition that all men equally have their failings. To forgive sin suggests a presumed lack of sinfulness on the part of the forgiver. If not, whence comes the right to forgive? So in Matthew 9, to the sick with palsy, Christ says, "Thy sins be forgiven." In Luke chapter 7, to the woman in Simon's house, "Thy sins are forgiven." Notice too his rebuke of others. None have experienced the task of rebuking others, if they be sincere in their introspection, without feeling a twinge of inadequacy in their own lives. Take this example, Mark's Gospel, chapter 10. Jesus judged the rich young ruler who claimed to have kept the law from his youth up by saying, "One thing thou lackest." This judgment was followed by the rich young ruler turning away. The record of Jesus' prayers focuses yet on another evidence that Christ took for granted no normal shortcomings in himself. Christ is never seen praying with his disciples. He prayed for them and possibly in their presence, but not with them. The significance is that were he to pray with them as he taught them to pray, he would have said, "Forgive us our trespasses." This prayer, Jesus never uttered himself. To do so would have Jesus confessing sins, an act he is never seen to perform. Especially notice that In the Gethsemane experience, though Jesus asks his disciples to watch and pray, he does not pray with them, but prays his prayer alone. Not only did Jesus' abstinence from prayer with his disciples support the suggestion that he felt no moral shortcomings, the content of his prayers themselves suggests this. Never while praying does he admit to shortcomings before God. It would be worth one's time to read the account of his prayer in John chapter 17, and to notice the apparent acceptance by Christ of his worthiness to be an instrument to perform God's will. As against all the above, and many other implications which can be found, there is only the supposed denial of goodness in the discussion with the rich young ruler. One account is found in Mark 10. The denial itself, when examined closely in its content, can just as validly be taken to prove the very position we have been explaining. What appears as denial of goodness is more likely to be a denial of goodness associated only with the conception of master, vis-a-vis good master, devoid of divine meaning. Jesus wanted not to be called good unless he also received recognition as God, for only God is free from sin. Close reading of the sources of Christ's teachings would reveal many other suggestions that Christ apparently lacked a sense of moral shortcomings for himself. That he lacked this in spite of his expressed ability to recognize the sins of man with more insight than anyone in history. The significance of this sense of moral perfection is seen when one remembers the universal sense of sin, which confronts all men with moral conviction. Indeed, a sense of moral inadequacy can so disturb one that at times he feels like the pathetic Huckleberry Finn described by Mark Twain. Quote, "It don't make no difference whether you do right or wrong. A person's conscience ain't got no sense and goes for him anyway. If I had a yaller dog and he had no more sense than my conscience, I would poison him. It takes up more room than all a person's insides and ain't no good no how. And Tom Sawyer says so too." In more philosophic words, "Go where you will," said William Morley Pasham, "the existence of a conscience of sin is an acknowledged fact. It is to be found everywhere and among all grades of human society. If we take to the crowded streets of the great city or move among the scantier tribes of the savannas, if we go where refinement and civilization gild and often soften down crime, or if we betake ourselves to live among the swarthy bearded Druzes, where sin reigns as tameless as the pennon that flutters upon the lance of his jirid, there is not to be found any who have not the feeling that in some way and at some time or other, they have failed to do always what is right. Indeed, it has been well said that the most characteristic fact of human life is not success, but an inward, if not openly, confessed sense of moral failure. It is relevant to point out here that the reputed founder of Buddhism, the Gautama Buddha, began his spiritual journey because of an explicit sense of moral inadequacy. Yes, as we have indicated, abundant evidence points towards a lack of this sense of moral failure on the part of Christ. To emphasize the significance of this lack in Christ, the testimony of history is unanimous that those characterized as most saintly have experienced a parallel development of a deeply felt sense of moral inadequacy. This is equal to, and along with their growing saintliness, as one student of Christ has aptly expressed, Christ is the exception. The note of contrition which ever belongs to the saintly soul is in his case, that is Christ's, wholly absent. Yet according to all human analogy, it ought to have been more pronounced in him than in others, as he surpassed them in the depth of his humiliations. Note, Christ's difference from the prophets. In this characteristic of moral self-consciousness, especially since many reduce him to just another Hebrew prophet. Without exception, the prophets recognize their moral inadequacies before God. Isaiah will suffice to exemplify this fact. In Isaiah 6, confronted by a vision of God, he confesses, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips and dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." All of the above leads to this question. Can one who appears to look on himself as perfect, having no moral shortcomings, be called good and wise, if not divine? Recognition of one's moral shortcomings is normally the mark of goodness and wisdom, and failure to recognize the same brings discredit onto a person. In the words of Thomas Carlyle, "Of all acts of man, repentance is the most divine. The greatest of all faults is to be conscious of none." Face the issue. Jesus was supernut or supernatural, for only one who is more than human can represent himself as perfect. If Christ be only a man, does not the sense of moral perfection label him as either deliberately deceitful or mentally deficient in his analysis of himself? Chapter 2. Jesus Christ ceded authority in himself. Jesus looks on himself as having ultimate authority on all questions on which he spoke. Excuse me. He takes his ultimate authority for granted and speaks from the frame of reference without any defense or stated criteria for his authority beyond his experiential assumption of the same. Look at just a few indications of this attitude. The discussion of the discussion of Christ's moral self-consciousness above described the actions of Christ in rebuking and judging others, in forgiving sin, and his treatment of the rich young ruler. Each of these actions presumes authority or right to so act or judge. Close reading of the passages reveals that Jesus offers no defense or justification for his assumption of such authority. He just acts as though his authority is ultimate and no apparent questioning of that authority or appeal to a higher basis is even suggested. We also consider Jesus' handling of the Jewish law in the above discussion. There is no question. But what Jesus respects the authority of the law, and he condemns others for neglecting the weightier matters of its legislation or for misinterpreting it. Yet, with unembarrassed and self-constituted authority, 13 times in Matthew 5 and 6, he corrects the people on true meanings of the law and changes traditional views. Jesus' attitude toward the prophets gives another indication that he took for granted the ultimate authority in himself. One example reveals the thought. In Matthew chapter 21, the parable of the husbandman shows Christ looking on the prophets as servants of the husbandman, God, but himself as higher than the prophets. He was the son of the husbandman. Jesus' method of forgiving sins is particularly illustrative of his self-centered authority when compared with pronouncements of Old Testament prophets. Read Nehemiah 9:17, or Jonah 4:2, or Isaiah 55:7, and notice that pronouncements of forgiveness of sin by the prophet always express something that God would do, not an authority of the prophets themselves. Jesus, by contrast, did not assure the sinner that a higher being, when appealed to, would forgive. He did not say, God will, or the Lord will. Jesus said to the one, I will. And to another, thy sins be forgiven thee. Many specific sayings can be collected giving direct evidence that Jesus considered authority to have root in himself. For instance, in Matthew 7, he claims that a man who builds on his sayings is like one building on a rock, and one who builds differently builds on sand. When questioned for apparent breaking of the law of God by acting on the Sabbath in Matthew 12, Christ declares, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. That's in Matthew 28:18, Jesus explicitly says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. What right has Christ, if he is but a mortal man, to claim such absolute authority? Surely it is right to question authority and to find criteria for it. Yet Christ took the absolute onto himself and judged others, passed sentence on their moral states, challenged and reinterpreted the highest moral code of his day and offered no defense other than the fact that it was he who uttered the authoritative pronouncements. Christ stands in stark contrast to several other wise and respected religious leaders in this respect. Though Muhammad, Gautama Buddha, and Confucius spoke with authority, their authority was not self-seated without explicit criteria being named. Muhammad, for instance, justified his authority by a vision alleged from God, which revealed the truth that he taught. The Gautama Buddha rooted his authority in a spiritual experience undergone. It was this empirical criterion of his own experience that justified the Eightfold Path, which he recommended as ultimate. As a person, he depreciated it. He depreciated his own significance in a farewell address to his disciples. Confucius based his authoritative pronouncements on a keen analysis of the empirical interplay of social relations, not just taking for granted a self-centered right to judge and to proclaim. Thus, the other religious leaders can be called good and wise without straining the meaning of those words. But Christ appears to take an authority onto himself beyond the right of any moral man. And further, he offers no justification for that assumed authority. Even the suggestion that his powers given him by God carries with it an assumed association with God in the sense of son, quite distinct from the status of a merely mortal man receiving revelation from an ultimate being. In short, Christ was different. Again, then ask the question, can one less than God make such claims about himself? More specifically, can Christ assume such authority if he is not divine? And if he is not divine, can he be called both good and wise when he looks on himself as having such unnatural and supernatural authority? Christ, chapter 3, speaks of the eternal world as though he had been there personally. As have most religious leaders, Jesus, in his teaching, dealt many times with the eternal world. In Christ, however, there is a significant uniqueness. He speaks as though he had personally existed in the eternal world and would return there. Or he wanted his listeners to believe this to be the case. For instance, in Luke 15:7, Jesus describes the joy in heaven over one sinner who repents. He gives no explanation of how he knows there is such joy in heaven. The statement appears to take for granted that his knowledge of events in heaven is beyond question. In Luke 10:18, he claims to have beheld Satan as lightning falling from heaven. This description refers to an event taken by Christ and his listeners to have occurred at an age before the creation of man. In the same passage, Christ encourages his listeners to rejoice because their names are written in heaven. Again, no reference is made to a vision, a revelation, or any other source for his claim that names are written in heaven. He merely adds another characteristic of the eternal world as though his knowledge is unchallengeable. Again, in Matthew 18:10, Jesus describes a scene in heaven in a way to convey the impression of firsthand familiarity with the eternal world. Likewise, in John 14:2, Jesus describes a place in heaven for his followers and mansions that he will prepare when he goes there. The somewhat skeptical question of Thomas in this scene brings forth an answer from which Jesus further demonstrates his attitude toward a relationship he holds with eternity. In John chapter 6, Jesus claims to have come down from heaven with such literal implications in his meanings that the Jews then murmured at him. In the same gospel, chapter 8, Christ claims he was before Abraham was, and again stirred up the murmuring of the Jews by such humanly impossible claims. Jesus' description of hell are no less significant in the implication that Jesus conveys a firsthand acquaintance with the eternal world. If you'd like, write these down. Matthew 13:41 and on, Matthew 8:12, Matthew 25:41 and 46, Luke 16:23-25 and 27 as examples of this tendency. Whether or not Jesus actually had an eternal existence is irrelevant to the present discussion. That he deliberately assumed such an existence by the nature of his discussions of the eternal world is very pertinent. One more. A contrast with other respected leaders is obvious. Muhammad spoke of the eternal world, but his description were based on visions from Allah, and he never implied an eternal existence himself. The Gautama Buddha gained enlightenment, a oneness with ultimate reality. This was a result of his own experience, which in turn could be obtained by all his followers who rightly followed the Eightfold Path. Confucius, when quizzed about life after death, gave a reply, the gist of which was this: we haven't solved the problems of this life yet, so don't ask me about the life to come. Christ, in contrast, spoke freely about the nature of the eternal world in such a way as to convey personal experience therein. He also implied a personal status in that eternal realm, not to be equaled by others. A question is again pertinent. Can Christ so consider his relation to the eternal world and still be called good and wise, if not divine? Now, we have in no wise proven that Jesus Christ was supernatural. We're not trying to at this point. We do insist that he was different. He was different to the point that he cannot be called both good and wise like other respected founders of religion. His claims and presuppositions about himself set him apart. To be both good and wise, Jesus' teachings about himself would need to be true and he is supernatural. If he is not supernatural, then his view of himself is an impossible view. And he was a super nut. We have looked at only three of his claims. And these three are the least shocking. His most astounding claims are the subject of volume 3 in this series. Its title is The Man Furthest Out. And volume 3 is coming next time. For now, that's the God School.